I assume Captain Sisko removed or destroyed everything of value?
Not everything.
What is that?
A message from Sisko.
I don't understand.
He's letting me know he'll be back.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between the Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, spraying graffiti all over Deep Space Nine.
And now, joining us from the future, accompanied by Agent Daniels, Carmen Cartenuto.
Hello, everyone. I'm from the future.
That's convincing.
That's what all people from the future say.
Yeah. Cam, what's our conundrum this week here?
We are going to talk about the best and worst story arcs.
AKA the evolution of storytelling in Star Trek.
Right.
Yeah. Essentially, we want to examine how storytelling evolved over the last 50 years. We start in like this era of 1960s television. And I can't help but notice, guys, that storytelling becomes more serialized, not just in Star Trek, but in television in general.
Right.
Where there are a lot of factors going into this, but I think we want to examine, you know, what story arcs work, which ones maybe needed some work, and how maybe we envision Star Trek Discovery working out in the future when it comes to storytelling. So how do you define a story arc? I mean...
That's an excellent question. Yes. Can you please define it for me?
Well, we went back and forth on this because I think in Star Trek, there's a lot of character arcs. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of kind of narrative threads where we have a character, a recurring character that may pop up. And then there's actual like kind of narratives. And what I think we find now, more so in television nowadays than anything else, is kind of this destination narrative. You look at a series like Lost... where it seems as if it starts in one place and there's kind of a destination that it has to get to, essentially get off the island.
Right.
You've got that in other series like Breaking Bad. Like, how does Walter White end up, you know? Those kinds of things.
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Cam, I gave up on that a long time ago.
Legends of Tomorrow.
Are you still watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
No.
I think you are, aren't you?
I am.
Yeah.
I am up to date.
So the other thing is... people may disagree about which arcs we've chosen to focus on. Mm-hmm. It's just, we want to keep it as straightforward as possible. It can venture into, it has the potential to get hard to grasp what's an arc, what counts, what does not. So
even Memory Alpha seems a little bit confused in many regards. Yeah.
The other thing is, I think we'll generally stay away from, like, say, two-part episodes. You know, we're tackling those with full episode reviews. But otherwise, why don't we just jump into it and start off with storytelling in the TOS era, where I don't think you're going to find anything like what we see in Star Trek Deep Space Nine with, like, a Dominion War arc. It's mostly kind of maybe recurring characters.
Yeah, you'll see, like, you know, Harry Mudd pops up in two episodes. There's even very few recurring characters. The first real arc with TOS, the series, doesn't actually spring up, interestingly, till 1986, which is when The Cage is released on VHS tape. And suddenly we have this Christopher Pike arc that did not exist before. Before, it was The Menagerie. That's all we had. But suddenly we have this arc of this, you know, captain who goes on this adventure and then is broken, and then we see him go back to the place we saw him escape at the end of The Cage.
Yeah, and it's interesting you bring up that, and it was never an intentional arc that was developed on the part of the TOS people. But, I mean, what do you make of this Menagerie journey, Carmen?
I actually was unaware that it was first released in 1986. I actually thought it was part of the... was it...
Like, it never aired on TV until like the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think Gene Roddenberry would take it to conventions and show it to people there as kind of like a hey, isn't this cool sort of thing?
Yeah. Right, yeah. Yeah.
Then I think you're right. I think that's probably the only really the only way that it TOS touches on it, because it's very much the product of its era, which was is like very independent episodes. Everything is reset at the end of every episode.
Right. It's sort of an arc born out of desperation to fill, you know, two episodes with the Menagerie.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it's one that I think, you know, you can listen to our Menagerie episode, hear us talk more about that. But I do like how this sort of accidental arc gives us closure to a character that's interesting that was completely dropped, essentially.
Oh, totally. Yeah. But look, it was 1960s television. They weren't aiming for, you know, story arcs back then. It was intentionally supposed to be episodic. I think the first time we really did see the TOS crew involved with any sort of real arc is in the movies, starting with Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and that's picking up from Space Seed, of course, with Khan coming back as a villain. That goes into kind of that Genesis arc with Spock being resurrected on a Genesis planet in the following film. And then it kind of culminates with Star Trek IV.
Whales.
Yeah. But it is kind of a story arc that we see. And it kind of has that destination. And then they end up back at Earth. And Kirk is demoted back to captain right where he belongs.
This film arc, do you feel it holds up? Because to me, part of the problem is the consistency of, like, the movies, like, what they are trying to be is so very different. I like the overall arc of how we get there, but when you look, compare, like, Star Trek II to Star Trek IV, they're very different films.
Yeah, in tone and everything. Like, yeah. And that's why it falls into, okay, I like Star Trek in that one of my favorite things, it can be anything it wants to be. Mm-hmm. And that goes not just from episode to episode, but from movie to movie as well. You know, we go from that very kind of dark tone of Star Trek II to a very lighthearted romp that is Star Trek IV throughout this story arc. But as a narrative arc, I think it's actually kind of unique. You know, we have maybe a Star Wars arc that seems more epic.
Right.
It seems, even though it's dealing with the death and resurrection of a very important crew member, it seems to be much more on a smaller scale than what you see in these kind of franchise arcs that we're seeing in movies nowadays.
Right. Okay. No, very much so. I mean, it's definitely a little less... it's aiming for a little less than the Godfather trilogy.
Yeah. Guys, why do you think that's this kind of narrative was not picked up in either the TNG movies or even like the Kelvinverse at this point? This story arcing here.
I think it's because studios just didn't want to release essentially sequels that were too heavily dependent on the previous one. Like they wanted audiences to be able to show up and none of it mattered.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was pretty audacious to even have that arc in the beginning, because when all you know of Star Trek is maybe catching a couple episodes on TV, you know there's the crew and they're on the Enterprise. So when there's a movie that starts off with them on like a Klingon ship, it's for the casual viewer, it must have been like pretty like
jarring.
Thank you. Yeah. It must have been pretty jarring to see like, oh, I know these guys, but that's not the ship I saw on TV.
And
but
we see with Star Trek IV, I mean, it opens with like 15 or 20 minutes of table setting, essentially reminding everyone of how we got there.
Yeah.
So you can see that I don't think people were dumb. I think honestly they would have been able to figure it out, but studios at that point were like, we've got to really hold these people's hands.
Well, now flash forward to the 2010s, and we've like every single movie franchise, these giant arcs, some of them go nowhere. I'm looking at you, Independence Day. why aren't they doing that right now in the Kelvinverse? Doesn't it seem as if that's kind of perfect, and that's exactly what studios want to be doing right now, is developing these kinds of ongoing film arcs.
I just think part of the problem is they've kind of dropped the ball with the Kelvinverse. I think when they started it, they had grand ambitions, and those ambitions just dwindled with each installment.
Yep. I even think it'd be the perfect time to do something like this. We see it with the Marvel, you know, cinematic universe. Yeah. That's got arcs galore. And we're living in the age of the internet where all that sort of meta narrative can be a lot easier to digest than back in the day when it was less connected in that way.
Is that why you're such a fan of the DC universe, Carmen?
Oh, it's the hidden gem of comic book universes, if you ask me. All these movies, it's a lot more subtle than the Marvel universe.
We also benefit now, though, from binge watching and home video availability. When we look at like TOS, TNG, people didn't necessarily have these episodes in their houses or these films in their house to rewatch, because VHS tapes were like $100 for a lot of movies back in the day. So you didn't necessarily have
Get your hands off my Laserdisc collection, Cam.
You didn't necessarily have the luxury of having all the Star Trek movies in your house to just rewatch.
Yeah.
So
guys, let's jump into Next Generation. We're getting more towards certain arcs, and jump in if maybe I'm missing something here, but why don't we start off with, I think maybe the most obvious one, but the Klingon Civil War. We see that developing first in Sins of the Father in season 3 of Next Generation, and that carries over to season 4. We have Reunion. It's like the Worf-Duras rivalry. It's really picking up. Well, he murders Kalar, of right. course. And yep. then finally we have, Kern returning for the actual war and redemption. And we see kind of the Romulan involvement there. So it's actually kind of surprising if you're going back and they're starting this in essentially the 1980s, like story arcs like this. How do you think the Klingon Civil War functions as a story arc that has a beginning, middle, and end, Carmen?
I really liked it in general, but where would you consider the end? Would you consider the end to be the... what was the movie where the Duras sisters...
Oh, Generations.
Generations.
I guess, yes, that is or did a it end fitting end yeah. for the Duras sisters yeah. and the Civil War. I mean, to me, I would say this story arc culminates with Redemption Part 2, and we yeah. find out that the Romulans are really tied to Duras, yeah. The House of Duras, and trying to bring about political instability, and that's revealed mm-hmm. at the end as well.
Yeah, I really liked it. I thought that whole... the political underpinnings and this sort of, foreign investment in empires.
Does it seem very topical nowadays?
It's very prescient.
You think about what's going on in the news?
Not at all.
No. Okay.
I think
foreign interference going on anywhere whatsoever.
None. I think the Klingons really benefited for as an arc. Like, that makes complete sense to me why you would arc the Klingons.
Yeah.
Because look, they want to tell Klingon stories. They've got one on the bridge, but I don't think the writers were ever like, let's tell a variety of Klingon stories. I feel like they came up with their main one, and then they're like, okay, let's continue off that thread.
Right.
You know, they're not going to go as wild and varied. So I think it benefits a lot. And I'm not a big fan of the Redemption two-parter. I think it's fine.
Oh, you've made your feelings clear.
Yeah.
I like that episode much more than you do.
Like, I don't think this is a consistently great arc, but I think it's a lot of times when we see the first stabs at these sorts of things, they're really, really bumpy.
Yeah.
This one, I think, is actually fairly confident considering when it began.
So what do you think was it that convinced the writers to go in this direction? Because I think
it was Dallas.
Yeah, with the Who Shot JR?
Yeah.
We're getting into this territory where they want a syndicated show to be episodic, so it's not confusing to listeners. But do you think it essentially comes down to finding interesting stuff for Worf to do? And it's going to be tough if he's just... I don't know. What are some Worf-centric episodes that are really successful that have nothing to do with his...
Birthright.
Well, his place in the Klingon Empire, though.
Right.
Like, I think they struggle to find good, interesting stuff for Worf to do, and I think it makes sense. Klingon politics.
Are you a little surprised that Worf was the character who essentially got the first arc? You know, early on, they were so fixated on, like, Data and Picard.
Yeah, but here's... If it's dealing with politics, then yeah. I guess it kind of makes sense, because what would the Riker arc have been? Like the return of his dad?
Alaskan politics.
Yeah. Yeah. can't beat that. But look, I dig the arc. I think it makes sense for a character like Worf. Well, one thing, though, that's... I think that they tried and attempted and failed, though, is the conspiracy arc, where it's kind of hinted at with Commander Remick, who's introduced in Coming of Age.
Right.
And we see this culminate in conspiracy with the worm aliens on the crew's spine.
It's like yeah. body snatchers. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but...
The problem with this is that as a two-part story, it's really cool. The problem is that conspiracy ends with these threads like, oh... This is just the beginning.
And then what happens, Cam?
We never hear from them
again.
For all we know, half of Starfleet is worm people.
That's very true. I think...
Who's the most likely to be a worm person on the Enterprise?
Oh, I was going to say Admiral Todman, but he's not on the Enterprise.
No, I'm talking the main crew. Who's the worm person?
It's Barclay. The worm doesn't know how to act like a regular dude, so, what do you think?
Geordi is the one that jumps to mind.
Okay,
you know,
I get that.
He seems uncomfortable in his human skin.
Yeah. But I think the conspiracy arc could have benefited from at least like one episode between Coming of Age and Conspiracy that is at least hinting that there is some weirdness going on.
Yeah.
You just have Remick asking all these weird questions in Coming of Age, and then all of a sudden there's Starfleet's half of Starfleet's been taken over by these worm aliens.
Right, and we know that there was kind of a battle behind the scenes in season one, and that Hurley would take
Maurice.
Over, Maurice Hurley would take over as showrunner. I don't know that he had any interest in the conspiracy story. Yeah. I don't think he did at all. And then you had the writer's strike landing in season two. I just think conspiracy was maybe too early for that story. Like, they should have maybe pushed that to, like, later down the road or something.
But, Carmen, are you surprised that, like, they're even testing this out in, like, the 1980s?
Oh, well, I'm more surprised. Well, yeah, I'm surprised it happened that early in the series run. I remember watching it, and, yeah, exactly what you guys said. Like, it just sort of ends. I think it was I didn't like it as a two-parter because it left so many things hanging. It probably would have been better as an arc, to be honest.
Yeah.
And Coming of Age is so clunky as an intro to that arc. Yeah. It's just literally like these random characters on the bridge and Picard being like, who are they? What are they up to?
Yeah.
Like, it's not actual story. It's just like characters pointing at two people being like, what's their deal? So
if we want to jump forward, you know, I mentioned, you know, how the Romulans were involved with the Klingon Civil War, but Cam, you and I, we've been discussing Sela a little bit in that.
All the time.
Yeah, but we have kind of the Sela arc as well, in which it's kind of set up in yesterday's Enterprise, and then she shows up in the shadows of the Mind's Eye, and that's where Geordi is essentially brainwashed. He's a Manchurian candidate. And we see the Romulans inserting themselves more and more in Klingon politics. And essentially, her arc ends with Unification Part 2. Cam, throughout this period, do you ever get a sense of what her plan really is?
No.
I have no idea. Like, I like Sela, but what they gave her to do, it added up to nonsense, really.
I think the problem is TNG wanted to do a Romulan arc. And we saw the introduction of the Romulans in the Neutral Zone, which is a pretty good episode, kind of goofy. But, you know, it's paving the way for greatness, essentially. Then, you know, you can see they latched onto Sela as their vehicle to do this. And I don't know if it's the character of Sela or they just didn't have a really good Romulan idea in mind. But it's kind of like these two things get mashed together. And so we're left with not only an unsatisfying Sela arc, but also an unsatisfying Romulan story.
Yeah, it very much like the conspiracy arc, like you mentioned, Carmen, it just ends.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, yeah, apparently she was calling on the Romulans to be embedded, Cam.
Embedded.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They would have been embedded on the planet Vulcan.
Yeah, and that's really the end of it. She gets, like, held up by, you know, Data and what have you and some security officers. And that's the end of Sela.
Yeah. Would you have liked to have seen more Sela, Carmen?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I would have. I'm a huge fan of the Romulans in general, and I kind of wish they'd got more sort of Klingon treatment, I call it.
Do you think Sela could have successfully been carried over to Deep Space Nine, perchance?
Ooh. Maybe. I don't know if you want to maybe saturate Deep Space Nine with too many TNG. I guess they didn't do Worf till later, though.
We had Tom Riker as well, the infamous Tom Riker.
And Vash.
And Vash, yeah.
Can I just point out, I think I might have said this before on the podcast, my favorite part is just when he peels off his sideburns.
Oh, it's badass.
Yeah.
Like, don't get me wrong. Yeah. I don't think any of us are super satisfied with the Sela arc, because I think we saw the potential there for much better, you know, narratives to be told.
Well, you know, we see the Romulans in the original series. You know, Balance of Terror is one of the all-time great Star Trek episodes, not just TOS, Star Trek in general. Do you think TNG, in their interest in doing the Romulans, you know, we saw early on they were interested in the Romulans. When they got there, when they were like, we have the Romulans, they were just like, I got nothing.
Well, but, okay, maybe not for a giant arc, but we get so many great, like, one-off episodes.
Sure.
I would not consider it as part of, like, this giant, like, Romulan arc. And that's why maybe some people take issue that we're not talking about, say, the Borg appearances on Next Generation, for example, or Q's appearances. Those to me are, like, more kind of one-off adventures as opposed to an ongoing narrative. So I think we benefit a lot from that. With regards to the Romulans, so I'm okay. If we had to endure a kind of a lame sort of arc, then so be it.
I mean, it did get us like Data and Picard in Romulan cosplay, so I guess that's something.
That's true. When I do Romulan cosplay and people want a photo with me, I make sure that they know that I'm actually Data in Romulan cosplay.
And it spawned action figures.
That's so true.
There you go.
Anyway,
isn't that what all arcs hope for?
Yes, we'll get into the Vedic Burial arc momentarily. Why don't we jump over to Deep Space Nine, which is a series, they've made it very clear, it's stationary. It's literally on a space station. So you're not off gallivanting, discovering strange new worlds every week. The people are coming to you, and they realize that there's going to be these ongoing story arcs there. Here's their first attempt to really do an all-out arc, which was the Homecoming, the Circle, the Siege. That's when I was alluding to the graffiti all over the walls of Deep Space Nine.
Right.
Three-part episode. And I think this is where DS9, it's surprising that they were able to continue doing narratives ongoing throughout the series, because I think they really fall flat here, where it's so much just focused on Bajoran politics.
Prime Minister Jaro, come on.
Do you guys,
Jaro, guys.
Guys, did you ever care about, like, Bajoran politics that much?
I cared so much. That is no hint of irony. I found all that stuff really interesting.
Okay.
What was it about it? Yeah. Bajorans?
I really liked how everyone in Deep Space Nine kind of existed in an almost like a political gray zone. For like the first time, it wasn't these clearly defined groups: Starfleet, Klingons, Romulans, whatever. Even in TNG, when the Klingons were no longer the enemy, there were still distinct bodies, political bodies. And then you had Deep Space Nine, where you had Federation personnel sort of just stewarding a Cardassian space station that is now Bajoran, but the Bajorans haven't had like self-governance for what, like 50 years, was it?
Right, yeah.
How long? Yeah. So I just liked how everyone was kind of, not jockeying, but everyone kind of was unsure of where they were.
Yeah.
And they weren't like clearly defined like the Klingons were, for example, you know, under Gowron. Yeah. Like everything just feels like it's up for grabs with the Bajorans. So I understand like how you can mine some really great stories out of that. And I guess the question is, Tyler, you don't feel that the three-parter did that.
This three-parter, to me, it was talking a lot about people I was not invested in,
right,
nor a story that really gripped me. Look, I'm a sucker for anything that has to do with, say, Kai Winn.
Right.
But this, to me, and I'll be honest, anything that has to do with Steven Weber, so props to him as showing up as the most incompetent Bajoran colonel we've ever seen.
Yes.
But this one just didn't work for me. Cam, were you invested in the story that was being told here in this three-part episode that kicked off season two?
I think a lot of the gravitas of this three-parter is brought by Frank Langella.
Yeah, well,
I mean, his heel turn, I think, really works. I actually like the three-parter, I think, more than you do.
That's
now,
not hard.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I may be wrong. Is this the one that introduces the Bajoran like hero who they want to be their leader?
It is, yes.
Yes, correct. Yeah, played by the guy from West Side Story.
Yeah. He's a shark.
I thought his dance number really sold the intensity of the situation.
Well, I can understand now why the Bajorans consider him to be a war hero.
Right, yeah. I mean, with moves like that. Those hips can kill. But I found his character the problem with this three-parter. Because that's a lot of the tragedy, is this guy who's not fit for this position and ultimately has to serve as sort of this noble sacrifice for Bajor. I never cared about him. And the actor, I mean, hey, like West Side Story, I said earlier, like he's capable of giving good to great performances. I didn't feel this was one of them. I feel like Frank Langella is the one owning the screen in this three-parter.
Yes, he makes for a great villain.
Why did they never bring him back?
Because Tyler didn't like him, that's why.
I just think...
No, he makes for a good villain, but like I think his arc, I think his arc was done. Like, what do they bring him back for? He's been, like, arrested.
Strange bedfellows, too.
Like, he... there's really nowhere for him to go, you know?
No, I mean, I guess true enough. It just feels like if you're going to have Frank Langella, you give him, like, a great going out in a blaze of glory type ending.
Yeah.
But you know, I think it's a. I think this is like early steps of serialized DS9 storytelling, and I think it's actually a pretty good early step.
Okay. I think it's so clearly just like a baby step.
I suppose, but when you look at the episodes that are building up to this, to like stories like The Storyteller, know, like it's a lot of really bad episodes happening early in DS9. To me, this feels like, okay, we kind of know what we're gonna do, and I actually. I found this actually kind of a at least mildly compelling first.
Okay. Hey, two against one.
Plus, it has some Burrell action.
Oh, you know, yeah. So. He's in that garden a lot.
Is that a euphemism?
Wow. Anyway, no. Look, throughout all this, though, DS9, they're planting seeds for the Dominion, and that's kind of, you know, sidestepped by Paramount coming in and saying, no, we want Klingons. Let's bring back Worf. We're going to do Klingons as the villains again, and we get, I don't know, baddie Klingons for one more season throughout season 4 and a little bit of season 5. What do you guys make of this Klingon arc, this Klingon war arc, where they're essentially decimating the Cardassians and they're hostile towards the Federation now?
Yeah.
Was it just a good excuse, Carmen, to bring back Worf?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I was going to say it was what it was. I don't dislike it, but it did feel like the Klingons went in, devastated Cardassia, and then were like, we devastated Cardassia. And then...
Well, I like how it literally ends with Sisko handing Gowron like a pad and Gowron putting his thumbprint on it. We've signed a peace treaty.
Yeah.
I'm like, wow, is that easy then?
Yeah, to me, this, I mean, Way of the Warrior is amazing.
Yeah.
But I think the problem with it is, for me, is that the parts that I look back on as being really interested by involve, like, the changelings. Like, once we find out, you know, that Martok is an imposter, that's what I'm interested in. It's not the Klingons. It's actually the changelings that are actually the compelling part of it.
Or even the, think about that season 4 finale where they go back to the Great Link, and then Odo comes out of it and says, Gowron's the imposter. And for the whole summer, you're thinking, oh man, the guy who started the war with the Cardassians is essentially a changing. And then they reveal it's Martok. You're like, oh, like it has layers to it. Like, yeah, I feel like as if this whole Klingon war arc was kind of just getting in the way of the DS9 Dominion story that they wanted to tell.
I mean, it is putting the pieces into place for the Klingons to join the Dominion War, yes, ultimately. So for that reason, it's sort of like, in retrospect, I appreciate it a lot more than maybe I would have working through at the time. Yeah. I've been like, get back to the, you know, Dominion stuff. But it's an arc that, yeah, it's not... When people talk about the great arcs of Star Trek, I don't think they're going to talk about the Klingon War arc of Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
But I think it has enough rewarding moments throughout it, and I think it ultimately leads somewhere interesting enough that I can't, you know, dismiss it.
Now, what do you think, Carmen? Do we at least benefit from the fact that we start to develop Martok as a character? He's introduced briefly in Way of the Warrior, and he comes back for Apocalypse Rising, and I figure, oh, that's the end of that guy, but not so much.
No, and thankfully, I love Martok. I think he's tons of fun.
Well, your new name is Cyrilla now.
Yeah.
Is Martok the coolest Klingon
the
of all
coolest.
Time?
Well, like, Worf's stiff as a board.
Yeah.
Gowron, he's not so cool by the end when he's sending people on suicide runs to cement his role as Chancellor.
No.
You got Tony Todd, who's pretty badass.
Sure.
But I think you got to give it to Martok.
I like Kor. I like Kang. You know, I like some of these original Klingons that segged into Deep Space Nine. But Martok is to me, he's the be all and end all of awesome Klingons.
Yep, 100%. And then I like General Chang. I think he's really cool.
I dig him too. Yeah. Cam thinks of Chang as more of a con ripoff, but I don't care. You got Christopher Plummer.
Unleash the dogs of war.
You've got Christopher Plummer playing a bald Klingon with a rat's tail and a bolted-in eye patch.
Yes,
I'm sorry there. I think what we're missing, though, is Martok did not have the bolted-in eye patch. That's what he really could have used with missing eye that he had.
TV budget versus movie budget.
Oh, yeah, he just that would have cost a fortune. Pulling that in and out of J.G. Hertzler's face every single day? You know, cosmetic surgery costs alone? I get it. Yeah. Okay, boys. Okay, so maybe we're not super big fans of Klingon war arc.
It's fine.
It gives us enough.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, what did you like more though? The homecoming siege circle arc or this Klingon war arc, Cam?
Oh boy,
that's a question. Interesting.
I would say the Klingon war arc.
Yeah.
What involves the Way of the Warrior?
Yeah. For that, and because of Martok, that's how much I like the character. But anything that deals with politics just has me like enthralled. So I did like the homecoming arc, but
I mean, as much as I love Jaro, he's no Martok.
He's no Martok.
Okay, but look, it ends essentially in season 5 with that peace treaty, and by end of season five, you know, we get to the beginning of the Dominion War with a call to arms, which to me, Cam, maybe we'll be revisiting the Dominion War arc in more depth in a few weeks, but we should touch upon this here, though. But we're introduced with a call to arms, which is, to me, is such a perfect season finale. We have the Dominion. They're teamed up with the Cardassians. Seeds are being planted throughout season five. And finally, it is on. They are coming back for Deep Space Nine. To you, is this kind of a moment when DS9 starts to change fundamentally?
I've only worked through the entire series once.
Okay.
I'm working through it again now. I'm just coming to the end of season three. I will say that at the time, no. At the time when I watched it the first time, it was just like the continued evolution of the series.
Okay.
Like, I was just, yep, we're moving along, and this is where we're going now. It didn't feel like suddenly all the pieces clicked into place, and suddenly Deep Space Nine is, you know, the greatest Star Trek of all time. It was already awesome. It's just like this was like another badass moment on the, you know, in a trail of badass moments.
And maybe I should rephrase that. Did the season six arc that started in the end of season five, did that seem as if, oh, we're seeing storytelling in a way we've never seen so in DS9 and maybe Star Trek as well?
I didn't feel that way the first time.
Really?
Through.
Really?
I mean,
okay.
You're right, though. It is far more serialized than any other season in as much as the story of what's going on goes across many episodes. Like, it doesn't feel like the other ones where there's a continuing story, but we have random episodes strewn throughout that take place completely separately of those arcs. But no, it's funny. It didn't jump out at me the first time through.
I think this is the Dominion Wars is where Deep Space Nine kind of differentiates itself, at least, you know, in retrospect. Like, mm-hmm. Maybe you're right. At the time, like, it might not seem that way, but
we had so much buildup, right? Yeah. Right from season two, and or I guess the three with the search.
Okay. It's curious that you say that, just because I can tell you at the time, it was unthinkable that, mm-hmm. I know all the fans were just blown away that the first six episodes of season six was going to be devoted to an ongoing arc.
Right.
Like, that was storytelling we'd never seen before in Star Trek. And I wonder if the fact that, like, I'm coming at it from the angle where I was watching it in real time.
Exactly.
Where you're used to television, like, yeah, you've seen
I was
your
an
Breaking
X-Files
Bad.
Kid. I was, yeah, watching all of those shows for decades.
You've already kind of grown accustomed to kind of the serialized form of
yes.
storytelling.
Yeah,
so,
for sure.
But I can tell you at the time, fans were just, like, blown away. Like, we'd never seen anything before. There's so many questions. The other thing was, is after they retook Deep Space Nine, a lot of people just figured, oh, I guess the Dominion War is over.
Right.
Not the case. And so this Dominion War arc...
People, you haven't seen the Paw Wraiths yet.
Don't make me cry. Don't make me cry, Tears of the Prophets. Cam, I what I do appreciate, though, but the seven-episode arc from Call to Arms to Sacrifice of Angels is that they don't seem like a big kind of blob of episodes. Like, I sometimes mix up what Breaking Bad episode was what, or what Lost, or, I think maybe what episode of, like, 24 was what.
I feel very much that way about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Like, you can't tell them apart? Or
yeah.
Yeah, okay. But with this one, like, to me, they're all very distinct episodes, all taking place within the confines of this conflict that's going on, which I thought was genius on the part of the writers, though. Carmen, going back, what do you think overall the legacy of maybe the Dominion War arc is?
Yeah, I was already sort of, when I went and watched Deep Space Nine all for the first time, I was already a little tainted by people's opinions of it. I'd watched, I'd grown up with Star Trek, but Deep Space Nine never really resounded with me as a kid. It felt pretty stationary. And so I've had people tell me, oh, if you're a Star Trek fan, why don't you... Like, you know, you've got to be a huge fan of Deep Space Nine. And so I was kind of already expecting this when I went into it.
Yeah.
So I did have the benefit of knowing it would be an arc. And I really like it. I think that is what makes Deep Space Nine Deep Space Nine.
And Cam, I think you knew that this was coming as well, right?
Yeah,
like,
for
sure. It was a natural evolution, but you also knew that they were telling, like, this big, long story involving the Dominion.
I think you would very much prep me for that.
Yeah.
But you were saying, what is the legacy of this arc?
Yeah.
That's a very interesting question, because when we look at the arcs to come in Star Trek, I think its legacy might be that Deep Space Nine made it look easy, and it very much wasn't.
Oh, the writers will tell you that it was one of the most daunting things that they ever undertook at that time, because they'd never done anything like that before in Star Trek.
And I think we see that Star Trek has never replicated it again. Not to the heights of what Deep Space Nine accomplished.
I'll say that.
There's ones coming up I like a lot.
Yeah.
But they never hit the heights of what this show accomplished.
Okay.
And, I mean, fingers crossed that Discovery can, but I'm not holding my breath, because I really do feel like what Deep Space Nine accomplished over its 7 seasons is very rare, very unusual, and just the fact that essentially they were ignored because, you know, TNG and Voyager were grabbing sort of all the execs' eyes. This, you know, kind of group of outsiders were making this show kind of by their own rules to a certain degree. That does not happen.
Do you know what the trick was?
Mm.
They did not include any alien blood oil.
What?
The X-Files?
Oh, God. Right. Yes, yeah. Exactly. But you know what I mean? Like, because the more execs that are watching something, the more likely it is to get watered down.
Yeah.
And
we've got some notes for you guys.
Look, I'm excited for Discovery. There's a lot of exec eyes on that show.
Oh, yeah.
And so I don't know that we're ever going to see something quite like what Deep Space Nine did.
Yeah, we can dive into Discovery a little bit later
for sure.
But why don't we jump over? Carmen, did you have one final thought?
I was just going to ask, like, so you think that it was the what really made that arc shine was just the scrappy nature of writers who were flying under the auspices of, what is it, CBS?
Yeah, feel that. And just the fact that
at the time, it was not CBS.
Oh, Paramount?
It would have been Paramount.
Ah, yeah, right, Paramount.
Pardon me.
Sorry.
And just the fact that they were not working on the flagship show.
Yeah. No, that's true. So I guess we've got the Dominion War stuff kind of sprinkled all throughout the final 2 seasons, but it really culminates with the final chapter. That's what they called, the last 9-10 episodes of Deep Space Nine?
No, that's a reference to the book, right? That Gul Dukat has?
Is it?
I don't know.
Coast Emotion?
Yeah. The one that burns up Kyle Paca?
Yeah.
I mean, Kai Wynn?
Kai Wynn. Yeah. He's literally reading the final chapter.
Yes.
Yeah, there you go. but look, from a storytelling perspective, I think the writers got to the point where they realized that they had created all these threads.
Yeah.
You look at, say, Next Generation, by the time you get to the end, they try to close some of their threads with maybe like Rolaren, for example, Wesley, to varying degrees of success. Here, I think they saw this as a very daunting task. We can't just do it like here or there. There's a big story arcs going on. There's big character arcs going on. Let's do it with, you know, kind of a similar pizzazz that we did with that arc that opened up season 6.
Right.
Well, how successful do you think they were at this kind of arc follow-up here?
I think they were actually freakishly successful. I think they kind of pull off about 85 to 90% of this arc closes off incredibly satisfactorily. I think where it falls apart is, as I prefaced before, when we get to I think really the problem is the closure of sort of the wormhole aliens,
yeah.
Sisko and Dukat. That's where, you know, when we get to the Paw race and magic books and all that, that element doesn't work very well. It's okay, but everything else about the actual Dominion War actually, I think, works really well.
And I'm totally on board with stuff like them trying to resolve the Worf-Dax relationship.
Yep.
But when you get into all this screen time devoted to the brand new Dukat and Kai Wynn relationship, mm-hmm. I'm just like, what am I watching here, guys? It kind of feels as if they're spinning their wheels to some degree. And they get rid of Kai Wynn and Dukat for an extended period. They thought that they were going to be parts of the story throughout this arc. They don't really come back into the final episode, essentially.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
It just felt like we've talked about this in the past, where they took Dukat that season as the sort of cult leader, it just didn't work in the Bajoran facelift. It's just not interesting. It gets kind of weirdly outlandish, and that's something that a lot of shows fall victim to when they get to later seasons. It gets a little bit too broad.
Well, okay. Throughout this arc, is there maybe a highlight and a low light that you guys can point to?
I think that arc was... I was more interested in Kai Wynn, actually, in that arc than Dukat. You're right. I did think him as a cult leader.
Did you want to feed her fruit in bed?
Yeah.
Is that it?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Really, really made me feel close to her, really appreciate her for the first time. But no, I thought her whole crisis of faith thing was really interesting.
Yeah.
And yeah, Dukat's role as cult leader, like you said, was just kind of weird. And almost just even a little out of character.
The Kai Winn moment I love, though, is when she just admits, like, the prophets have never spoken to me. Like, why am I following them at this point?
Yeah, like, the Kai Winn arc over, you know, the course of the show feels consistent. The Dukat one does not. I think maybe the low light. I don't think it's the worst moment of the, you know, of the end of Deep Space Nine. But Sacrifice of Angels, where he kills Jadzia with the magical item.
No, that was... Tears of the Prophets.
Tears of the Prophets. Thank you. I think that, to me, might be the low light. Even though there's episodes coming up that are maybe worse, like when you know, Jake is taken over by Paul Wraith.
Sorry. No, I was speaking about the final chapter specifically, though.
Oh, what's the worst part of the final chapter?
Yeah, these are the final 9-10 episodes that closed off Deep Space Nine. This is, again, kind of an ode to that season 6 arc, where those are all very much connected, telling one serialized story. And the final chapter is doing the same here, and that's... There's no real one-off.
Right, episodes. No, I was thinking more of the arc of Dukat and Kai Winn. No, in terms of the low light of that, I do think it just comes down to, I think, Dukat.
Okay.
I don't even think it's Kai Winn. I think it's Dukat.
What about an episode like Extreme Measures, where it's O'Brien and Bashir wandering around in Luther Sloan's head for 45 minutes?
Highlight of the series.
Okay. To me, I was just kind of like, wow, we've got 2 episodes left in... This is one of them. It's dealing with the changeling disease. And I just, like, to me, I was just like, that was them kind of spinning the wheels a little bit, in my opinion.
The 90s were all about sort of like virtual reality. Because remember, Disclosure?
Do
you remember that? The ending of that was like all a VR sequence with Michael Douglas.
I remember my mom was like really concerned that I was reading the book.
Oh, okay.
I read the book. Just cracked as I said book.
Brought you back to that time.
Yeah, it did.
But also there was like Virtuosity in 95, you know, the Denzel movie. So like virtual reality was a real thing in that episode.
Johnny Mnemonic.
Mm-hmm. That episode feels very much like kind of the product of that time.
Mm, yeah.
I don't recall disliking it that much, but it does kind of jump out landing that late in the series.
Little known fact, this episode was the inspiration for The Matrix. The Wachowskis, big Star Trek fans.
I can imagine.
Yeah. Anyway, look.
not Ghost in the Shell, no.
how do you think this arc culminates with What You Leave Behind, though?
I think it's pretty beautifully.
Yeah.
I think it's a pretty fantastic ending. I look forward to when we cover that two-parter.
Was it a way that satisfied you, Carmen?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I remember thinking that it actually wrapped up quite nicely. I'm trying to think if anything stand out about it, but yeah, I think it just really it ended pretty well.
Do you think that an arc like this final chapter could have worked in other series, or was DS9 unique in that it was the stationary series that you know. You can't really devote like 10 episodes to like this ongoing story that's going to tie up all the threads in, say, Next Generation, for instance. Like, what if they created like a random, like, Romulan plot again? We went back to Sela for the last 10 episodes of Next Gen. Like, I don't think that would have worked.
I think the difference is that none of the other series kept all these side characters in play throughout the series right into the end. And that's what Deep Space Nine did.
Or kind of like... an ongoing narrative, other than, we'll get into it next with Voyager, though, with the journey home, so to speak. So I think unique, or DS9 is unique in this situation. So why don't we get into Voyager, where I think serialization, out of the more modern Star Treks that we're going to discuss, serialization here was kind of the weakest. They wanted to go more of that episodic route, but we do have...
I mean, the journey home aspect is setting the show up for serialization.
Yeah, I was going to say, when I first heard about the topic for this podcast, I was like, well, Voyager is one big arc, if you think about it.
Did you think about it?
I did think about it, okay. And I thought about how they tried to marry those two ideas of the episodic Star Trek that, you know, everyone kind of knows and loves, and a probably trying to capitalize on the popularity of the Dominion War.
Well, and this is where I get into destination storytelling, where they start at a point and you figure you all know where they're trying to get to by the end, which is back to Earth. And so they kind of fulfill that, but it seems as if they're only occasionally interested in getting back to Earth, though. It doesn't seem to be their top priority much of the time.
Well, it also feels like Deep Space Nine didn't have a simple goal throughout the series. It wasn't just like, this whole series is about, you know, Bajor coming to this, to the Federation. There was other, all these other stories that were folded into this, you know, the Cardassians and all, you know, Romulans, Klingons, all that sort of stuff. The journey home, like, that's all they have. There's no other real arc to be told, or no other kind of complications to this overall story of Voyager other than we've got to get home. Right. And I think that's what weakens it compared to what Deep Space Nine was trying to do.
Yeah. But there are specific arcs that we can touch upon.
Yep, definitely.
Look, we've got the Kazon that are constantly trying to take over the ship.
Fan favorites.
Culminates with Basics Part 2.
Yeah.
Voyager gets the ship back after they lose it. I don't know if this arc ever really works because of how boring the Kazons are.
Yeah, Carmen, we just recently wrapped up the Kazons. We did our Basics episode. I talk about that two-parter. I'm just curious, where do you stand on the Kazon?
Oh, I'm... I really could
he
not...
He cosplays as them.
Yeah.
He's doing it right now.
I came in my my weekend Kazon look. It's very hot here, so, you know, Kazon shorts. Which is just scavenged from other shorts I have.
Yeah, fair enough.
No, I really could not care less about the Kazon, and I really tried to care. I tried to see the upside in every, even like my least favorite Star Trek episodes, I try and find a positive spin, but man, I don't care.
Like, even within this arc, we have like mini arcs, like with Mike Jonas being the traitor after it's revealed that Seska is also a traitor.
Right.
And within that, we also have disobedient Tom Paris. Do you remember, Lynn? He's just being insolent towards Chakotay the whole time. And it's so that, you know, they can reveal who the traitor is aboard this. The ship, and I'm just kind of hitting my head against the wall the whole time, saying like I don't care about any of this. Like,
I think you would care though if they'd evolved it in an interesting way. Oh, yeah. It's like they kind of set it up very broadly, and then they don't really take it anywhere interesting. Like, had it ended in an exciting way, then you might be like, yeah, that was actually pretty cool. But they kind of peter out. I mean, the one about the turncoat on the ship, I mean, it like culminates in like Neelix being like an investigative reporter.
Yeah.
Like, that is, imagine if Deep Space Nine had hinged on that sort of conceit.
Well, then it would not have been, do you recall Mike Jonas falling into that pit of
I do.
Fire?
Yes,
it would have been Jake Sisko, not Ben Sisko, shoving Dekat into a pit of fire at the very end, you know.
Does he jump in with him?
I'd hope not. Neelix didn't have to, so, yeah.
I just don't buy anyone, any Starfleet person defecting to the Kazon. It's just so weird and phony. I mean, I could see it for like the Romulans or Cardassians, but like...
Mike Jonas wasn't Starfleet, though. He was Maquis. Same with Seska.
But
actually, Seska was Cardassian. She's a Cardassian infiltrator within the Maquis.
Almost less so in that regard.
Yeah.
It's kind of, though, like when like Patrick Dempsey wanted to team up with the Decepticons in Transformers 3. You're like, what does he get out of this? And I don't really know what anyone gets out of teaming up with the Kazon.
Yeah.
Cam, I gave up on those Transformers.
I know. I was really proud of that, dropping that reference.
Yeah. He's McSteamy or McDreamy?
Dreamy.
McDreamy. Okay.
I believe so.
That was his character name in Transformers?
Yes.
Was he playing the same character as Grey's Anatomy?
Same character.
But just
character.
In the
same
Transformers
same
universe?
Same continuity.
Interesting. Yeah. Maybe I will pick it up.
Megatron appeared on that season of Grey's.
Okay.
He was a new intern.
Okay. He's very good with the in surgery. Very precise.
He's great with the machinery.
Yeah. So, guys, Kazon story arc maybe doesn't work so well. What do you guys make, though, of... Look, I would not describe Q as having a story arc on Next Generation. I mean, there's kind of narrative threads, you know, with the that trial that humanity's going through. But he definitely has one on Voyager, where we have kind of this civil war that goes on that starts with the introduction of Quinn. And then we have that child that's produced out of the Civil War, and then...
Keegan-DeLancey,
who, I guess, riles up everyone left in the Q continuum with his appearance there. So this is a three-episode arc. Cam, I think this is more successful than the Kazon arc, but what do you make of Q's appearance on Voyager?
I like Q. I like John DeLancey. I like a lot of the elements of these three Voyager Q episodes.
Yeah. I mean, I like Death Wish. Like, I thought that was a good one.
Sure. Yeah, I like Death Wish. I think part of the problem is, and this is something we talked about in our Q episode with Patrick Johnston, but the idea of the Q is so fantastical that it works a lot better to have Q come into these mundane places, like, you know, Deep Space Nine, like the Enterprise, like Voyager. Like, these are static environments we know very well, and they feel comfortable to us. When you take us to the Q worlds, which are, in our imagination, really exciting, and you see it's like a recreation of the Civil War.
And Tuvok is holding a musket up to another Q's head, and
yeah,
that means that Q is now defeated?
I mean, it's not even like the Civil War of like Gone with the Wind, where it's sweeping. It's like the Civil War of like the Beguiled, where you just kind of hear sounds outside the window.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just not that exciting.
Yeah.
I like, you know, again, I like elements. I like Susie Plaxton's character. I like what Q goes through, his character journey through these, you know, through these three episodes. But I don't know. I can kind of take or leave it. Like, if you just told me that Q never came back after all good things, I'd be like, cool. I don't know, Carmen, where do you stand?
Yeah, no, I thought it was kind of out of nowhere to have like the Civil War. I guess it was a Q Civil War, but yeah, I wasn't a huge fan.
Look, it's not great serialized storytelling here. You know, and I don't think they ever really wanted Voyager to be too serialized, but this was an example of it, and I just don't think it works so well, even mm-hmm. though I like John Delancey quite a bit. But
right.
What was intentional on their part, though, is when they introduced the Hirogen. Mm-hmm. These were going to be kind of...
You mean Predator.
Yeah, well, exactly. But look, Voyager, like, it started off with, like, a lot of recurring aliens like the Vidians or the Kazon, and they really moved away from that. Yeah. And we get the character. Well,
don't forget the Malon.
The Malon. I was just going to bring up the Malon.
I can't wait for our podcast episode on the Malon.
We'll have to do one of these days. But yeah, the garbage aliens, for those who don't recall.
Yeah.
Literally, the garbage aliens. But we get the Hirogen arc, where these are kind of predators that specialize in hunting.
That's the precise word to use, the predators.
But they're specialized in hunting, and so they eventually take over Voyager again. Voyager has a knack for getting taken over.
Kind of like the original Enterprise on TOS.
Yeah. But look, we've got some cool episodes. Like, I do like the idea of them hunting down Species 8472, for example.
And that's the episode Prey.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually really, really love the episode Prey. I think it's absolutely fantastic.
But?
Voyage. No buts.
No. But what about the arc, though, when it culminates with the killing game?
I would just like to stop at Prey for a second and just say that is a fantastic episode that I think I've often said that Voyager rarely gets above good. I think it actually gets really close to great with that episode.
What?
But let's just take us down to the path of underwhelming, Tyler.
Well,
take us to the killing game.
I think I have fonder memories of the killing game than you do.
Yeah.
But to me, it's... Look, they're trying to bring their Hirogen full circle, where like we can do a holographic hunting nonstop. This is going to be great practice for us. And it just seems like a typical TV venture into cliched World War II storytelling.
Right.
So I like it more than you, but I don't think it's a great way. I think Star Trek...
You just like seeing Neelix in a bicycle with baguettes in his basket.
That's my phone's wallpaper right now. But I just realized, Ken, we could do a Nazi arc as well. Like, Star Trek has kind of this weird thing about Nazis.
Patterns of Force, yeah, right from 67, I think.
Stormfront.
Yeah.
Killing game.
Yeah.
We'll see how Discovery tackles the Nazis when they get at it.
Can't wait.
Yeah. So, like, the Hirogen arc, I think it's a bit of a mixed bag. There's some episodes that are pretty cool. There's others that I'm just like, okay. I see it. I do think that they are kind of a cool alien. It's not one that we've encountered before in Star Trek, which I'll take that over just kind of the bumpy-headed alien of the week.
Yeah. I mean, the thing with the Hirogen is that I feel like early on they really want to explore these aliens, you know, right from Message in the Bottle into episodes like Prey. Like, they really want to look for complexities in this alien species. Once we get really kind of past Prey, like, as you said, the killing game, and also Flesh and Blood, which is the two-parter with the holographic people that kind of go amok. They're not using the Hirogens to examine them or really flesh them out in any way. They're using them as a springboard to other stories.
Sure.
Like, the Hirogen are not the central feature of the killing game or the Flesh and Blood stories. So I really think they kind of ran out of interesting ideas after Prey, and it was just like, well, the Hirogen are cool, but we have nothing to do really with them left. Like, they were very simple in conception. They were not the Klingons or the Romulans.
Yeah.
Or even the Vidians.
And look, I think we can bring it back to Barclay for just a second here.
As we always do.
The Barclay arc that we experienced in Star Trek Voyager, where essentially he's trying to get the crew back home through his Pathfinder project. Did we need to see a return of Barclay in Star Trek Voyager for an extended episode arc? To me, it seems as if he's taken such a step back as a character.
Yeah.
We see, like, we brought it up in Most Awkward Moments, where he's talking to Deanna Troi about how he struggled to connect with people ever since he left the Enterprise. To me, I don't know if I needed a return of Barclay.
No.
And I don't know if Voyager would have been the right platform for that either.
I agree with you. I like the idea of the Pathfinder project. And, of course, Owen Paris. I mean, what more could you hope for in Star Trek? But I think the problem is that the Pathfinder project never feels like it impacts the show in an exciting way.
Well, we get to see Tom and Owen make contact again.
That's a thing. It's it just kind of allows guest stars to appear on view screens.
Yeah.
Like, that's not a compelling addition to the series. I don't know. I mean, I think it's fine. I don't have any real hatred towards it. I think there's, like, you know, maybe the odd good episode. Like, author is fun. But, you know, it's an arc that is serviceable, but it is not one that's particularly memorable.
I can't wait to see Barclay's great-grandfather on Discovery.
It'll be good. Yeah. Well, Carmen, you're in season 4 of Voyager now, but I think we can bring you back in the conversation. If for any of those who are kind of interested in maybe our thoughts on the Borg in Voyager, I think most of those are kind of like one-offs, you know, and it's more about Seven story character arc more than anything else. But we did do an evolution of the Borg episode maybe a few months back, or maybe about a year and a half ago, Cam.
Yeah, if you go to subspacepod.com, every week I put links to relevant podcast episodes, so that one will definitely be in there.
Yeah, but why don't we jump back into something you can talk about, Carmen, with Enterprise and the temporal Cold War. Cam, this is not something that the writers initially wanted to do. It was actually mandated.
I can tell.
Well, it was mandated by this, I believe, the network, by UPN at the time, because serialized storytelling was becoming more popular in television. And it makes sense. We already saw a lot of that in DS9. Voyager started to take some cracks at it to varying degrees of success. So what's the story arc of Enterprise? It can't just be people exploring for the very first time. There has to be an ongoing thread.
Yeah.
Does the temporal Cold War make much sense to you guys?
My answer is no. The temporal Cold War was something I feel like there's a fundamental flaw with the temporal Cold War. Is it because it's people in the future constantly changing things? I could never figure out how you would ever stop it. When you look at the Dominion War arc, I can understand how there's an end point to that. The temporal Cold War, I was just like, well, how would you ever stop this, especially in the 22nd century?
Yeah, let's say your opponent in the temporal Cold War arc does something to you, so you just go back in time and stop him. It's just kind of a constant loop.
Yes, and you know, you've got the Darth Sidious, you know, speaking from like the 31st century, was it?
That's what they said.
Yeah.
But we've heard some behind-the-scenes stuff that maybe not...
That was like Archer?
Yeah, it was supposed to be Archer, in fact.
It's all
maybe
very
Archer
confusing.
Went to the 31st century? I don't know.
And so you get like a character like Daniels who shows up and is sort of like Archer's guide through the temporal Cold War. I like him. I think that actor brings a lot to the table. But to me, again, like that arc just got more... You know, it's kind of like you referenced earlier in this podcast about the black oil on X-Files.
Yeah.
The temporal Cold War goes the way of the X-Files conspiracy. By season 8 and 9 of that show, you're just like, what is going on? And that's how I felt about the temporal Cold War by the time we got to like Shockwave at the end of season 2.
Like you've lost it. Right?
I'm just like, I don't know. If I can't even imagine how you would ever wrap it up, then it means that there's no real arc to it. It's just a straight line of me like being like, I don't understand. Yeah. They're just flowing one into another.
Time travel arcs in sci-fi are always sort of like just like little plot minefields.
Yeah.
And I'm not a fan of them. And I have my Enterprise knowledge is the weakest out of all Star Trek knowledges, but I have seen
it shows.
Yeah. I have seen a lot of these temporal Cold War episodes, just, you know, in syndication. And Yeah, like it's, you know, maybe it's because I wasn't watching them properly in order, but
it doesn't matter. Trust
me. It's a mess. Yeah, I guess not.
Yeah,
no, time travel.
And it all
maybe it would have mattered if you're watching them out of order because it's all like time there and here. Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, when you get to the end of it at Stormfront, yeah. Part 1 and 2,
Nazis.
That felt to me like such a rush wrap up job, as in like we've got this story like unresolved. We have to end it as quickly as possible.
Yeah, but you know. Credit to Manny Coto, like, that's not the story he wanted to tell, but he figured at least let's give some resolution to this. This is not something they would have resolved in, say, season one, Next Generation, for example.
Of course,
you
yeah.
know, it would be the
conspiracy
arc. Exactly, yeah. But there are some good things out of it. Like, I thought the Suliban were kind of cool, you know?
I liked them a lot.
They're
kind of like Sela. I love the Suliban, I love Sela. I don't like what the shows do with them.
Yeah. So I think this is a bit of a misfire just because I could never invest in, say, time travel so much. Although we do get the benefit of having the Xindi War arc being tied into this as well, because, of course, the Temporal Cold War, they're giving technology to the Xindi in order to attack Earth and go from there. The Xindi War arc, though, is an entirely different story.
Yeah, of course. And I think why the Xindi War arc works well, whereas the Temporal Cold War does not, is the Xindi War arc is easily definable. The Xindi are building a weapon that's going to destroy Earth, essentially.
Yeah.
What is the Temporal Cold War trying to achieve?
I never knew.
That's the problem, yeah. Right? And so, you know, in the Dominion War arc, we know exactly what the Dominion want to do. The Xindi War, I mean, I don't think it's as strong as the Dominion War arc. I mean, it's one season versus a series, obviously. They just had far more room for complexity and growth throughout Deep Space Nine. But the Xindi War arc is pretty fantastic in my eyes.
But what do you make of this? Because you had said that nobody's approached what DS9 did, but nobody devoted an entire season to one single story arc. I mean, there was like some one-off episodes like North Star.
Yeah.
You know, but
is this the season two where there's the one where Hoshi like winds up with that psychic mutant?
The
psychic alien?
The creeper?
Yeah.
There's like one, but that's kind of tied to the arc as well.
They're all loosely tied.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But look, we've never seen like a Star Trek series devote an entire season to one arc. And I think Discovery is actually going that way where it's kind of a destination, you know. Carmen, you haven't gotten to the Xindi War arc yet.
No.
So, but have you heard people besides us talk about it?
No.
So it's legacy
really?
Yeah. Continues. Okay.
The only people in like, actually my mom, I think, is the only person who's watched all of Enterprise that I know of other than you guys. And like, yeah, you know, she mentioned the Xindi, but.
Can we get her on the show next
week?
Yeah, sure.
why are we booking Carmen?
Yeah.
Okay, but look, I think this is the biggest leap forward in Star Trek storytelling since we saw that first DS9 war arc that started kicked off season 6. Like, this is an entire season devoted to one goal here. Some great standout episodes.
I feel like the Xindi arc has really gained steam over the years, too. Like, I would imagine when season 3 aired, it was met with, I mean, I'm sure fans were into it, but not that many fans were watching the show at that point. So,
I'm included in that.
Of course,
I did not watch it in real time. I tuned in like after season 2 of Enterprise. I would tune in here or there, but I just wasn't all that interested. And
right.
So I remember tuning in for the premiere, but I didn't keep up with it. And I do remember, I'm pretty sure I watched bits and pieces of the finale and watched Archer run away from that giant fireball that you love so much.
Of course, 0 Hour. Yeah, I think what makes this arc, like for me, really effective is actually what it's criticized for. It's often criticized for being a little bit jingoistic and kind of against the ideals of Star Trek.
Right, yeah.
What I love about it, though, is that, yes, this whole arc is a response to 9/11. But because of that, there's a passion in the storytelling that I don't know would exist otherwise. And I think that is ultimately what makes it hold up so well. Like, I think there's, you know, you said the writers didn't want to do the Temporal Cold War. It's obvious.
That they wanted to do this.
Yes. Like, you can tell that they were invested and they had a story they wanted to tell with the Xindi War arc. Is it, you know, a little bit jingoistic? Yeah. but it also speaks to the time in which it's made, and I think that's okay. I actually think that makes it more interesting.
Okay. Why don't we jump forward to the next season, because they go in a different route. They know that they should be doing more serialization, but they kind of break it up into smaller arcs instead. So we get things like, say, the Augment arc featuring Brent Spiner. Mm-hmm. We get the Vulcan philosophy arc, essentially, yeah, with The Forge, Awakening, and Kirshara.
That's what it was pitched as.
I loved it, like, way more than you did. I'm a big fan of Vulcan politics.
Yeah.
Like, you know, just not Bajoran politics. I don't know. And then we also get, say, Babel 1 United Enar Romulan arc as well, which I think that's really setting things up for what they want to do to season 5, which I'm guessing would have been like the Romulan Earth War arc, essentially.
Right.
That's my best guess. But out of the three that I mentioned here, Cam, I mean, maybe what stands out to you is them kind of capturing how storytelling should be going forward in Star Trek.
The Augments arc was the one that I love the most.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah, it was very much so.
Not the Andorian Enar.
That would be second.
Okay.
To me, it loses a little bit of steam with the Enar. Like, once I'm, you know, watching ice worms fall, it's like, you know. I mean, it ends.
I don't know. That Romulan drone ship was pretty cool, though.
Yeah, it was in the first couple parts. But once you get to the Enar, it kind of becomes a little less. It just feels like some of the tension is let out of that, you know, that arc a little bit.
Okay.
But whereas the Augments arc, I really loved. This is what Star Trek Into Darkness should have been. You know, an approach to this sort of, to these characters that is different. Like, it's crazy when you watch the Augments arc, how they took a Khan story, made a complete twist on it, and delivered something really satisfying and engaging and fun.
And the reason why I kind of bring this all up together is because what we're seeing here are strewn throughout season 4 is these ongoing story arcs, as well as like a lot of two-parters. So they're going for more kind of like story clusters, you know, as right, opposed to one ongoing thing that we saw with the Dominion, or also that we saw with the Zindi. What do you make of this kind of storytelling? What do you think about the idea of this, Carmen? Because you haven't gotten here yet. Do you like the idea of like kind of more like mini arcs as opposed to like these big ongoing threads?
Yeah, mini arcs are a lot more manageable, I think, for writers, especially, you know, what the writers for the Dominion War said and how they said it was daunting to write. So yeah, mini arcs, I think, definitely. And you can kind of plan them a little better, I imagine. And I'm not a TV writer, and you know, manage them a little better. So yeah, no, I'm a bigger fan of those.
Okay. And I mean, how often would we look at, you know, other series, whether it's Voyager, TNG, etc., and take some of these kind of stretched out stories and imagine tightening them to like 3 episodes, and they could be really fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the beauty of Enterprise in its 4th season was knowing how long to take these stories, whether it's 3 episodes, whether it's 4, and just having a really tight beginning to end. There was no drop threads, you know, this is not like Conspiracy or anything like that. They knew the story they wanted to tell, and it was allowed to be paced how it needed to be paced.
Okay, guys, I think before we wind up the show, we will want to talk about Discovery a little bit more in depth, but why don't we go through it and maybe talk about our top 1 or 2 or 3 arcs that really did well, the best, and then maybe our bottom 1, 2, or 3 that not so great. Cam, do you want to kick it off?
I mean, the Zindi War and the Dominion War arc are kind of, how did those not make the top
okay,
three? You know what I mean?
You stole mine.
Yeah. I will say it's not necessarily a story arc, but I have a lot of affection for the arc of Kor going across the series. From, you know, the original series right into Deep Space Nine. I really like the idea of taking a classic Klingon on a journey. And so that is kind of one of my affectionate favorites, even though it doesn't necessarily tie into what we've talked about on this episode.
Okay. For ones that I'm maybe not a huge fan of, like I mentioned the Sela one.
That's on my list,
It just didn't amount to much. And then also, like, you know, afraid to say that the Temporal Cold War, like that was across, like, 3, it literally stretched from season 1 to season 4 until they finally resolved it, and I just didn't care at all.
And the Kazon arc for me.
Yeah, that's a good one. Carmen, any here that you want to highlight?
The Dominion War is definitely my favorite. Yeah. And yeah, my least favorite is going to be, probably like anything to do with the Kazon and what little of the temporal Cold War that I saw. Just because I have a very low tolerance for time travel stories. And okay. I just think they're so messy.
Well, guys, why don't we jump into it and talk a little bit about what we hope to see and what maybe we expect to see from Star Trek Discovery, because they've made it clear that there is going to be an ongoing serialization of this. From what I gather, season one is supposed to tell one big story. Mm-hmm. So we're going back to that. And I'll say this, Cam, I think you and I have touched upon it on the podcast before, but one of the things that I love about Next Generation is that it can switch tonally from week to week. It can tell different genre stories week to week. I never necessarily know what I'm going to be getting. But I suspect if you're doing like modern day television storytelling, tone is a very consistent thing through, you know, say a Mad Men or Breaking Bad or The Sopranos or The Wire.
Or Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Sure. So my concern is, are we going to get a Star Trek series that seems a little bit more amorphous in both its storytelling and its tone?
That is my big worry.
Yeah.
Is because I really love these offshoot episodes, that feel different. There's a reason the original series is my favorite, and it's because every week you don't know where you're going to go. And I am very worried that that's going to be lost going forward. You know?
I thought Lost was a great show. I don't know what you're talking about. I mean, maybe that season six wasn't its best, but you know.
But no, that is like the one thing I'm very worried about being lost. And TNG was really great at that too. You know, I like when Star Trek walks the line between serialization and episodic TV, kind of like Deep Space Nine did. I'm not excited, I suppose, about the idea of Discovery being like a 15 episode arc.
Yeah.
It's like, well, if they can do things like the Zindi War did, where they're telling offshoot stories involving, you know, creeper aliens with psychic powers, then maybe.
That's what I'm hoping for.
Yeah. But you don't get the tonal shifts. And sometimes I think it's really fun to have, you know, tonal shifts in episodes. I think it's very unlikely we're going to have an episode like, say, the one where Bashir wants to be James Bond. You know what I mean? Like, I just don't see that type of story popping up in Discovery.
I suspect that Discovery is going to be a more serious show than a lot of the other ones. We're not necessarily going to get those campy, silly episodes that a lot of us enjoy, actually.
What would you say is the most serious Star Trek show to date?
Well, I say DS9's the like darkest,
yeah,
but, you know, isn't the, but there's so many like goofy episodes, like the Ferengi episodes, for instance, you
very
know?
Broad, yeah.
And does it get much broader than a lot of those Ferengi episodes?
No,
like I think Deep Space Nine is actually capable of going from the lightest to the darkest,
yeah.
So it's hard. I would say maybe the most serious, maybe Next Gen,
yeah. I mean, you do get those holodeck episodes, but I think maybe the difference is that. Deep Space Nine was quite good at comedy versus TNG wasn't really.
Yeah, I agree.
And so,
I mean, there's a couple funny moments in TNG, but
for sure.
I think they actually had the comedy beats down way better on DS9.
Yeah, I mean, TNG does character comedy beats quite well sometimes, like with Worf especially, Data. But when it comes to actual comedy episodes, it's a little dire. So, I would say
that Geordi's a barrel of laughs.
Yeah, exactly. And I kind of agree with you that TNG is probably the most serious Star Trek.
For a TV series that I think really did it right beyond the Star Trek universe, is though I mentioned Mad Men as you know, the tone is fairly consistent. But the thing is about Mad Men, what they did is they'd have like, I'm never going to get one Mad Men episode mixed up with another. There is kind of like the story that's going on, and then there's the ongoing arc that ties into that kind of bottle episode. And one episode you could be watching a serious existential drama, and the next episode you'll essentially be watching kind of a caper to a certain degree. And I think Mad Men really balances that episodic storytelling with the serialized storytelling in a way that I never have seen yet on TV. You know, I don't want, like, I love The Wire. That's probably my favorite TV show, but I don't want Discovery to be The Wire, so to speak. Like, yeah. I like the one-off kind of adventures.
Same. I think if they can walk the line, it will be great. And yeah, actually, Mad Men's a really good example that I didn't actually think about. But yeah, like Star Trek, you know, there's a reason so many of the series did the episodic, because it's you know, what Star Trek was originally, what it originally was. But, you know, like the continuing storyline is something that TV has evolved to handle. And so,
It may not even be clear to us as viewers until after the season ends on Discovery how exactly storytelling has evolved at this point for Star Trek. Like, we may be kind of gauging it for a long period without realizing fully what the story arc even means or how serialized it's going to be.
Definitely. And I think we've seen, you know, when we look at the arcs we like versus the ones we don't, that if you don't have the arc figured out and have written it to be compelling and exciting, it can sink an entire season. So, you know, Discovery's success or failure to me depends on how exciting this arc is, how, you know, compelling it is, how interesting, how Star Trek it is. If it winds up being like the temporal Cold War, you've sunk an entire season. Right. Like, season one of Discovery will be a bad season. You know, you don't even have a case like, say, the original series. You know, Tyler, you're working your way through season one. You know, early on, there's a handful of really shaky episodes.
Yeah.
But you have a lot of huge highlights. You don't get those highlights if you are consistently telling a story that stinks.
That's a good point.
Yeah. And I look, at least if I'm watching kind of a dull episode, I at least know that the next TOS episode is going to be it has a potential to be a solid one.
Right.
But if we're taking the story in a direction that I don't care about or I'm not invested in, then I've got like, what, 8 more episodes to go.
Right. In which case, Discovery becomes a show more about, so which seasons do you like versus which episodes do you like?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's daunting.
I have to believe, look, maybe we'll have to evaluate Star Trek Discovery as a whole once it ends after 7 seasons.
Question, has this podcast episode made you more apprehensive about Star Trek Discovery?
Look, I'm not one of those guys that's going to be poo-pooing it out of the gates. I'm totally down for whatever adventures. And look, I'm not going to be judging it right off the bat. Like, if the series premiere doesn't initially grab me,
yeah,
I'm willing to, you know, give it a go, like invest.
That's one of my least favorite things is actually when a new show comes out and like critics watch the premiere and is like, well, this show's terrible.
Yeah.
It's like, how many pilots did you guys love? A lot of the shows that I genuinely love, the pilots are bad.
One that sticks out for me is actually BoJack Horseman. I needed 3 episodes to get into that show and I had to force my way through those first 3 episodes. But one of my favorite shows. But yeah, if you asked my opinion of that show after episode 1 or 2, I would have told you, like, it's the worst.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, look, there's going to be a lot of people on Facebook and what have you chiming in after Discovery. And I suspect there'll be a lot of negative opinions. I think we've seen so far that that's a likelihood. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we will not be doing that on this podcast. What I think we should aspire to do is maybe point out issues we see to track as the series goes, but not to be like, good Lord, what is this flaming train wreck?
Yeah.
Yeah, so. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. Let us know what your favorite story arcs are, or your least favorite, and let us know maybe how you would have fixed some of the weaker ones, because we're not bright enough to do that, and we haven't done that on this episode. Okay, so Tyler, where can they find us on Facebook?
Yeah, go to facebook.com/subspacepod, or else go to your search bar on Facebook and just search for Subspace Transmissions. Add us, like us, because we're offering kind of premium services to our listeners. We're, Kim, you and I, we are going to be posting, if we have not done so already, an exclusive commentary episode.
Number
only,
2.
Only accessible. And number 1 was only accessible on the Facebook page. So you have to go there in order to get some of this exclusive content. But we're doing a lot of fun stuff there. And it's going to be even more content going up when Discovery premieres. So don't miss out on anything. And look, everybody's on Facebook. You've got no excuse, listeners.
And I think this is a commentary that people are really going to want to hear.
Yes.
Like, Threshold was definitely a quirky first choice.
Yeah.
I think this one people are going to be, if they weren't excited by Threshold, I think they'll be excited about this one.
Yes.
So, yeah. Okay, well, what are we doing next week?
We are going to be examining Star Trek for Beginners, Cam. This is going to be an episode that we've never done quite like this before, but essentially we pitched your sister a number of episodes that we're going to make her watch without telling who picked which episode, with the sole purpose of trying to draw in a non-fan into the franchise. And it's going to be up to her to decide who got closer to her taste.
Right, because with five series, one pick each, one of us is going to have more hits than the other. Maybe like 3 versus 2 or 4 versus 1. So it's a little bit of a contest here, too. It's not just us pitching episodes to a newbie. Tyler and I have something at stake.
Exactly, yeah. This will be a fun one, guys.
I think so, too.
I think this is a great idea. I love it.
You're the one who pitched it to us. That's why you're saying that.
Of course. I have a vested interest.
Yeah.
Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Vedic in the Garden Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N, N as in Neelix, comma, a briefing with.
Okay, and Carmen.
I'm at Carmen Live. That's Carmen with an I, as in I can't believe we didn't talk about the Vidian arcs.
Which are also great.
All great.
You also have a podcast going, right?
Oh, yeah. I have a comedy-themed D&D podcast called Adventure EXE. You can find us on Facebook, Adventure EXE Podcast. And our website is www.adventure-exe.com. And you can find us on iTunes or Podbean as well. And it's just our episodes are an hour or less, and we're mostly focused on entertaining rather than, you know, the rules. So
we're all about the rules here.
Oh no, pitching to the wrong crowd.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.